from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the program. Of course, you know Robin Sachs as a former ADA out of Los Angeles County, author, violence expert, advocate, an attorney of the first degree. I'm not sure what that means. And always a pleasure to have on the program. And we have another guest from the Sachs Law Firm, Steve Lang, and I'm going to let Robin introduce him.
Dana, so nice to be with you tonight. It's been a while. But Steve Lang is the media director at the law offices of Robin Sachs. He comes with a wealth of media knowledge and a talent for being able to see what is a story, what's something that's going to grab the media's attention, which is something, Dana, you and I, you throw me the questions every time without fail on every one of your shows is how much is the media affecting this case? So instead of being forced to be the one to answer the media questions, I thought I am going to bring the media arm of Robin Sachs here to make sure that I give you the best possible answers and stick with me with what I know, which is the law.
Yeah. No, and you've done good with the media stuff too. You're kind of a media mogul. I haven't seen you on Dancing with the Stars or anything yet, but I understand.
That'd help you.
I understand.
No, Dana, that is a great idea. That could really bring the ratings in.
You know, well, listen, and what I mean by that, Steve, is, and everybody, Steve Lang, Nancy Grace is on there. I think she's dancing with Sonny Bono or somebody. Or no, Chaz, I shouldn't say that. Sonny Bono passed away. But
yeah. That's terrible, Dana.
I think Robin would be great on that show. Anyway, Steve, I want to talk a little bit about, obviously, we'll get into some high-profile cases, but let's talk about media a little bit. And when we do a show, even when I do this dopey show, I want to throw out that hook, that something that will grab the audience, not just an name Robin Sachs, which is plenty of good enough, but that hook that the audience will grab and say, geez, I want to listen to that show live or on the podcast, and we'll get into all that later. Actually, the guest that's on right after you, I've got a guy that survived 9/11. Now, there's lots of people, and the 9/11 story's been told a million times. People love to hear it, but the interesting story about this guest is he's blind, and his guide dog took him down 78 flights of stairs. So that's my hook. That's the story I want to get out there besides you guys for the people to listen to. How important is that hook, whether it's a crime story, whether it's a story about 9/11, or whether it's a story about Robin Sachs on Dancing with the Stars?
It's everything. You know, it's why people tune in. It's why, as you've just said, I mean, you need something to get an audience. And with all these channels and internet and everything, it becomes more and more difficult. So that's what they're after. So, you know, when you hear a story that, and they're somewhat predictable by now, I think, you know, we could all say that you hear basic a true crime story and people just they want to know.
And when we bring up the place Aruba, and Robin and I will talk about this in a minute, Steve, but here we go, Aruba again. Joran Vandersloot, we've covered that story right from A to Z. I've interviewed the Holloways and everybody involved. You name it, we've done it. Robin Sachs a million times on that story. Here it is, Aruba again, and people right away, as soon as they hear about that place, another unfortunate missing person. Some people blame Aruba, some people don't. How important is that coverage of the previous case? And I know Beth Holloway has come out and said that finally Aruba is starting to do a good job with a case like this, for the media to go out and cover it again.
Listen, if I'm Aruba right now, I'm all over the United States American press to cover this story, because this is a chance for Aruba to regain the respect and the tourism. I mean, as you know very well, Dana, you and I worked the whole Natalie Holloway story, and you guys broke it over there at Scared Monkeys well before even most mainstream media was involved in the case. And the fact of the matter is a lot of the initial press behind the whole Holloway story, besides the fact that she was a beautiful, blonde, missing college-age girl, was that this was an opportunity to boycott Aruba and affect tourism, truly have media affect the tourist market, which would hopefully then affect justice. And we'd like to think that that effort was successful, and I'm sure that Aruba wants to throw back now and use this as an opportunity to show how Aruba is able to do it correctly. I think it's also not so coincidental that now we see that there has been actually some movement in the Holloway case as a result of this case.
You know, Steve, when you see this this case, Aruba, and we could bring up different cases all the time, but when you see this and you see how it was covered, the Greta Van Susteren's and the Nancy Grace's night after night after night, 50, 60, 70 shows in a row, we're not seeing that so much this time. But is there, and is it possible, Steve, to have over coverage of a case like this?
You know, there was something that we used to say when I was in the sort of mainstream media, and it would go something like this: by the time we're getting sick of it, the audience is just finding out about it. And so that can kind of explain why you get, you know, nonstop KC, nonstop whatever the story is, because there's not a lot that breaks through to an audience. Now, you're probably much more sensitive to what you're watching and hearing, and so you're noticing it. But the average viewer has got the TV on and is making dinner or making breakfast, whatever the time of the day is, and they're not really hearing it the way your ears are.
Yeah, and you know, that's a good point. And I've mentioned it many times, and there's been that criticism and that compliment. I'm going to use both terms, Steve, about the forum that I work with, the Scared Monkeys, social media, whatever you want to call it. And the caring, some would say obsession, with cases like this, some of the biggest criticism I've had is interviewing Joran van der Sloot's lawyer, for example, bringing on Drew Peterson before he was charged with murder and interviewing him a couple of times, yet criticized but listened to more than any other program. What about the people? What about the folks out there? I call them Joe and Mary Sixpack, that like to sit down and cover these stories. Are they just drive-by watchers, or is that big group out there that really care?
Well, I mean, I think that there's all types. If a story reaches a certain level, and I think we can name them, we can go back to O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
We can then go to Casey Anthony. I mean, those are just trials, obviously. But when you get a story, and I think since you brought it up, Natalie and Robin Gardner, who is now missing and presumed we don't know what in Aruba again, I think those stories have certain elements that attract Joe Sixpack. I think you've got, you know, sorry to say it, a very attractive woman, seemingly innocent to something like this, who's gone missing. And I got to tell you, you know, Dateline NBC has and CBS 48 Hours has made a living on doing these true crime mysteries, and there's a reason for it. You know, if you look a couple of years ago, those shows were doing different types of things, and now they're devoted entirely to these kinds of stories.
Steve, I got to jump in here because you're making me want to jump out of our seat. You and I both know, you having come from major traditional mainstream media, of course, naturally referring to the Datelines, Dana and I are both looking down our nose at that, knowing that the true power of crime and coverage is not Dateline and 48 Hours, it seems. It seems that it's the blogosphere, the internet, and everything else that's out there that's really kind of keeping these stories alive, no?
It's been a while, Robin, but I want you to put your prosecutor hat on. If you're just tuning in, Robin Sachs and Steve Lang are here. Check out Robin's webpage, robinsachs.com. And I've asked you this question before, and I've asked defense attorneys before, and I never forget asking Drew Peterson's lawyer about media coverage and trying his case in the media before it even gets to court, and he said he loves to do that. Anthony case, for example, is it a big mistake to have it covered so much when you're the prosecutor?
Listen, Dana, you and I have talked about this a gazillion times. When I'm going to have two different hats on here, and since you told me my prosecutor hat and not my media hat, as a prosecutor, life was never good when the camera was in my courtroom. No good can come of it. I hated cameras in the courtroom. If you look at my website, you will see very little coverage of anything that I ever did in the DA's office. And that was not by happenstance. That was purposeful. Staying below the radar allows a case to be handled purely without any of the potential good or bad of the media. In my cases, fortunately, because they were rape cases, they were very rarely ones that the media had the opportunity to get involved with anyway, so I had that extra layer of protection. But I do think now that I have a defense attorney hat on as well as a media hat on, I think that there is an insatiable appetite that the American population has mm-hmm. for crime. And I think that that understanding is something that if we don't feed it with factual information, it's going to be fed with BS, so we might as well give the public and the society the message that they should hear, which is the truth.
You know, Steve, we here at the blog know that the mainstream media cherry-picks our information all the time, uses it, sometimes gives us credit, sometimes doesn't. I like to call what we do Main Street Media because we give an opportunity for the guests to speak their mind. We don't work in 30-second or 3-minute sound bites. As a former media guy or as a current media guy, let's talk about the difference between, say, 5, 6, 7 years ago to today with social media, the internet, the blogosphere, if you may, compared to what it used to be.
Well, I mean, for one thing, a good friend of mine who worked in the sort of the, I don't know what you would call it, the tabloid, you know, celebrity sites that are online now, and he said, you know, we used to talk about deadlines. We'd have a deadline. The news would be at 6 p.m. The news would be at 11 p.m. Whatever your deadline was, and this goes for print as well. And that's all changed. There is no deadline. It's 24/7, and any time there's a development, it needs to be updated. And that's something nobody had to deal with 3-4 years ago.
And you're right, and that's the big difference between today and the other day. But Robin Sachs is the advocate. I want you to put your advocate hat on now. And all the stories that need to be told, and you've done it, you and Stacy, and we've done it here on the show for a number of years, you and I, giving the voice to those that haven't been able to get on that that TV show or that interview to get their voice out, whether it's missing persons or an unsolved case. Let's talk about that a little bit, Robin, and do we need more of what we're doing right now to give a voice to those that can't get it?
Well, I think that shows like yours and actually I think because of shows like yours and because of Justice Interrupted and because of some of these other avenues for getting information out there, we as a collective whole in our own media ways have kept these stories alive in order to force mainstream media to pick them up. I mean, I don't know how much you're following the Lauren Spire case, but that case is getting huge amount of attention based on Twitter. We've seen it, you know, in case after case that the social media market, the blogosphere, all those other avenues are then creeping their ways, forcing people like Nancy Grace, like Dateline, like 48 Hours, to bring these cases forward and give it the attention that they deserve. And it happened in the Long Island serial killer case. I mean, it took 10 or 11 months for the media to pick up that case, but because of that, you know, because of people insisting to keep it alive vis-a-vis the internet, it forced the media to take a look-see and a listen.
You know, with the reality television, Steve, all you got to do is look at television a few years ago to today, and all the top shows are reality shows. And we were talking a little bit off air about you know, some of the crazy things that are out there, and I do a commentary each day. I'm not sure if you know that or not, and I'm going to slam toddlers in tiaras in my commentary here coming up. What happened? What happened to TV? You're like, what the heck happened to TV?
You know, it's very interesting that you bring it up. Again, I'm gonna go back a few years. If you recall the Jenny Jones
yep.
incident, where there was a murder after a guest was his secret homosexual love affair was exposed.
Sure, yeah.
That I read an article, I believe it was in the New York Times, about this, that they cited that as a sort of pivotal moment of change for that genre. And I wonder if the suicide with the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills,
right,
if that will have the same impact. And that's really the question right now. And it does not appear that it is. I mean, I remember, as you probably do, after the Jenny Jones incident, and of course there was a trial, it was, everyone looked at, you know, all the Jerry Springers, all those shows looked at each other and said, are we really doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Should we be doing this, and should it be done differently? And I wonder if that moment might arrive. If not, it should soon, because you're right, it has changed. And if you think about what reality TV is and isn't, I mean, reality TV is documentary. It's the oldest form. I mean, it's, in its purest form, it's just a documentary, and we love documentaries.
Yeah,
but it's become something else these days.
Yeah, absolutely, and it just makes you sick when you flip around the channels. And like I say, I'm going to go after Toddlers and Tiaras here in a commentary, because I'm so sick.
Oh, dear.
I'm so sick of that. That's just, it's nothing but, and I'm going to ask you, Robin Sachs, we use the term exploitation a lot in these programs that we use or talk about, and there's a news story out about a Toddlers and Tiaras segment where they dress up a little three-year-old girl to look like Julia Roberts from the Pretty Woman movie, a prostitute, and that's got to be the worst exploitation that's out there, and shame on TLC for even airing that crap.
I think there's another one where it's like they dress up like Dolly Parton.
Yeah, jeez, it's nuts. So Robin, as an advocate, as someone who likes to go out and teach and protect children, if we can't protect children, I don't know who we can protect. There's a lot of creeps out there that will feed off this Toddlers and Tiaras nuts, and are we just feeding the deviants that are out there?
Well, I got to tell you, as a mom and as an advocate, I'm completely torn, because it's like it's disgusting in one way, but it's disgusting that we have to even think that it's disgusting.
Yes.
And that's truly the sad thing. I just sit here and I think about how I have a fabulous detective friend who is actually a LAPD child abuse detective, long seasoned detective, and her husband is actually a seasoned detective. So you're talking about a dual law enforcement family who, when they had their first baby, and Halloween is right around the corner, and they had a little girl, every year, kind of as a, you know, joke, they chose a notable woman archetype celebrity to dress their kid up for Halloween. And I remember at 3 years old, they dressed their little daughter up as Coco Chanel, wearing, you know, a Chanel suit. And in one way, you could say that's disgusting,
yeah.
Okay? You could say making people think that money is an important value is disgusting. And so I think that the fact that we have to have these conversations, that what we're doing is either turning on other people, affecting the values of our kids, affecting our abilities to grow naturally. I do think that there's a little bit of the microscope on this type of stuff that is unfair. However, having said that, you know, Toddlers and Tiaras is just gross,
yeah,
on any level. And so the fact that that show can satiate anyone for more than, you know, 3 minutes, and that they can make a whole show on it is frightening, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve Lang and Robin Sachs are here. Check out Robin's webpage at www.robinsachs.com. Let's talk about Steve Lang a little bit. Working in a law firm, we all know Robin's background. She introduced you and talked about you a little bit.
Can I just give you a little tiny piece of Steve Lang, just so you know, just
sure
how my history began with him.
Yep.
This is someone who, thankfully, was our counterpart, Dana. You know, you may not even necessarily know this, but in some of our work, he was one of those news people that when you and I had stories, that I would pitch to stories, and he was truly the other side, comes straight from hardcore media.
Okay. So what does Steve Lang do at the law firm of Robin Sachs?
I'm going to let Steve answer that.
I was just going to say, I'm going to let Robert answer.
Yeah.
You know, we actually, because I'm fortunate to have someone like Robin here, we develop a lot of our own content. And so some of what we do, you might see or hear on your show or any of the other media shows. And some of it we develop and put out on our website. And, you know, we're constantly looking for interesting cases, interesting stories, or anything that we might have particular insight into. So, for example, right now, we're gearing up for the Conrad Murray trial,
right,
which is about to get full-blown attention here in L.A. And that's, you know, she, because of her time in that office, in the DA's office, has particular insight into the players, you know, the judge, the prosecution, what's going on there, and also has the advantage of being able to look in from the outside as now a sort of a media legal expert.
And with the big cases like that, and Robin, the experience that she has in the media that she's done, there will never be an end to them, whether it's Conrad Murray or whatever the next case will be. And I'm going to ask Robin this. How do you choose? What do you look for?
Well, I have to tell you, I'm going to clean up what Steve said because that's what I do around here. We not only comment and look at some of kind of these big high-profile cases that are going on here in Los Angeles, but we are kind of very forward-thinking and recognize that media does come in all different angles, and there are people that do rely on the words that they hear from people on television, and because of that natural conduit to the people out there, I do get a lot of phone calls, and I used to spend a great deal of my time referring those phone calls out to other lawyers, to other people, and hoping that they would be handled with the love and attention that I would, you know, give them. And unfortunately, what I would find out is that I would hand cases off, and it didn't quite get handled in the way people wanted to, and people would end up coming back. So instead of referring those cases, we keep them here, and we take some cases that have no media value to them whatsoever. I mean, there's a bunch of our cases that allows us the flexibility to take on the pro bono cases that allow us the ability to go on television, and we use the cases that we have that are not pro bono, not media cases, to be able to sustain the law practice and have a practicing firm of attorneys handling all sorts of cases. So it's a real nice avenue to be able to kind of be the merge of media and law in a way that it hasn't been done before. I mean, you laughed mentioning Gloria Allred. I mean, Gloria Allred still, you know, if you are at her office, she'll still send out, you know, I'm pretty sure a typed, if not maybe it's emailed, press conference release that she's going to have a press conference in her library, and every single news camera in LA will feel like they have to show up because God forbid they don't.
Yeah.
But here we don't just do that press conference where it's me wearing a red St. John suit with my client telling her sob story. We actually go behind and really get into the nuts and bolts that we can work with and combine with media to take their story, to not just make change for that one victim, but to make change for victims in that similar situation.
Yeah, how important is that? Steve, I'm going to give you the last word, and I'm going to ask you this question. I always ask Robin this. Cameras in the courtroom, how important is it to what you do today and what you used to do?
I remember when it changed, and I got to tell you, I love courtroom artists, sketch artists, but the story, it's a different, you know, it's a visual medium, and for TV anyway, and I think for anyone putting clips on the internet, it's all about watching, you know, unfortunately watching every single person in the courtroom.
Yep. It,
you know, you can't make up for that. So I think it's essential, and I think in its sort of pristine form, it's essential for us to learn and to, you know, everything they say, you know, people talk about why we need cameras in the courtroom. And I think on the other side, the dark side is we get to see stuff we'd never see,
yeah,
you know, otherwise.
No, that's true. Robin Sachs and Steve Lang from the Robin Sachs Law Firm, thank you, and we'll talk soon.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Robin Sachs and Steve Lang, and it's interesting. Check out Robin's webpage at robinsachs.com. You'll learn more about her and Steve. We're going to take a break. You know, no one can forget September 11th, 2001, and my next guest, who I interviewed many years ago, certainly can't forget that. He is a 9/11 survivor, Michael Hinkson. And we're going to take a break and come right back on the Dana Pretzer Show and talk to Michael. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. September 11th, 2001. Where were you? I know where my next guest was, and I'm going to let him share that with you, Michael Hinkson. He has a new book, just came out in August, called Thunder Dog, and it's released by Thomas Nelson Publishing, and I want to make sure you check that out at any of the book retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc. I interviewed this gentleman many years ago, and it's always a pleasure to have him back on the air. Michael, how are you, sir?
I'm doing lovely. And you?
I'm great. It's been a number of years, but it's nice to have you back on the show.
Now, thanks for having us.
You are in New York City tonight while we're talking, September 11th, 2001, again, a day that you'll never forget. I got to tell you something, Michael. When I try to keep up on guests, even guests that I interviewed many, many years ago, and when I heard about Roselle, and we'll talk about that in a second, it broke my heart. And I'm sure it did yours too. And
well, it was a tough decision, but it was the right decision.
Yeah.
So, as sad as it was one we had to make, and it doesn't necessarily make it better, but there's strength in knowing that we decided correctly, and so she's in a better place.
Well, and at peace is an important thing.
And not having pain is important. And
Isn't that true?
She was in an incredible amount of pain. So
now, I want my audience to know this, and when I introduced you earlier on in the show, I talked about your vision impairment. So I want the audience to excuse the pun, focus on that right now. September 11th, 2001, where were you?
Well, actually, to put it the other way, it's not so much my vision impairment, it's your light dependence that we have to worry about, because that tends to blind you as to
right.
to the fact that sight isn't the only game in town, and that people who don't have any dependence on light are able to function in a lot of ways that y'all do, but we use different techniques. And so our limitations don't come from the fact that we can't see, but rather the fact that y'all think that because we can't see, we can't do anything. And so that's something that we're working as hard as we can to change, and Thunderdog hopefully will help educate people a little bit more to recognize that rather than being so pushy and thinking that, well, you can't do anything because you happen to be blind, that the real blindness comes from their own lack of knowledge and their assumption that because they can see, they know what they need to know, and that isn't true. So we hope that tends to help to educate people a little bit. As I said, light dependence is a disability that any person who uses their eyes all the time tends to suffer from. Thomas Edison came along with technology to fix that, but the fact of the matter is that only means that you rely on that technology. So why is that any more amazing than blind people relying on technology to do things and using other techniques to do things that you use your eyesight for? Only because life has gotten more convenient for you because of technology. So the reality is there are alternatives. On September 11th, I worked as the Mid-Atlantic Region Sales Manager for a computer company. We had our offices on the 78th floor of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center. I had a staff. They were out working that day. I had a colleague from our corporate office who was in the World Trade Center with me on the 78th floor, and we had some early arrivals for the first of four training seminars that we were going to be conducting that day.
Now, again, for those that have covered my show or if I've watched listened to my show for a while, you will have you know Michael's story, and you can check out his webpage. There's a link in the show notes for you to go there. What first brought your attention to a problem?
Well, and as you said, people can go to www.michaelhinkson.com and learn about it. We have some speeches recorded there that people can listen to, but also they can learn about Thunderdog, and it's one place to order. If people buy it on the website, it comes autographed and potographed with Roselle's paw print. Roselle was my guide dog at the time.
Right.
It's the only place where you'll get the autograph in her paw print, as we call it, a potograph.
Awesome.
But immediately we knew there was a problem because the building sort of began to sway. We heard a muffled explosion. It started tipping over, literally, because tall buildings like that are made to be springy, although something has to spring the building over, which it did. The airplane hit it. We didn't know it was an airplane. None of us did where I was, because we were 18 floors below where the plane hit.
Sure.
And on the other side of the building. And, of course, people are always saying, well, of course you didn't know because you couldn't see. And, of course, the reality is that's why I say that you all have the bigger handicap than we. The fact that you think that I couldn't tell what was going on just because I couldn't see it. But to be fair and direct about it, nobody knew what was going on where we were.
Sure.
Unless you can see through the building and you have X-ray vision like Superman, the reality is no one can see it from 18 floors down and the other side of the building. So we had no clue as to what had happened that day. And actually, I didn't know the causes behind it, although I figured out an airplane hit the building while we were going down the stairs. The causes behind it didn't become known until actually after both towers had collapsed.
Roselle.
My fifth guide dog, yes.
Exactly. For those that don't understand what a guide dog can do for you and what you can do for your guide dog, let's talk about now how she reacted.
She stayed asleep under my desk until the building had become vertical again, and then I came in the office from standing in the doorway, and she came out from under my desk. I took her leash and told her to heel, so she came around on my left side and just sat and yawned and wagged her tail, not indicating any concern on her part. But a colleague who was in the office with me, someone from our corporate office, David Frank, who was in for the seminars because he had account responsibility, so he was there to support his customers. David looked out the window and saw fire and smoke above us and started saying, there's fire and smoke and there are millions of pieces of burning paper falling outside the window. We got to get out of here right now. And basically started to panic. And I was saying, slow down and don't panic. We'll get out. And he said, no, you don't understand. There's fire and smoke. We got to get out of here. And I kept saying, yeah, but slow down. We'll get out of here. Without any concern. Don't worry about it. Partly because as the leader of the office, I wanted people to focus. But I also knew something that no one else around us was observing. I had a piece of information which was all crucial, and that is that sitting next to me was a dog who wasn't indicating in any way, shape, or form that she felt nervous about what was going on. You've certainly read stories about dogs that got their humans
Sure.
out of burning buildings because they smelled smoke long before the humans did. Roselle wasn't indicating like she had any sense of any of that and wasn't acting nervous at all. So when she was just sitting there, not reacting to any of this in any adverse way, I knew that she wasn't detecting anything that I was missing. So as a result, I knew that we could evacuate and leave in an orderly way to get out of the building. Now, that could have changed, of course, but you can only go by the information that you have at the moment,
sure.
And that's what I used. So I got David to focus, get our guests to the stairs, and start them down the stairs, and he came back. I had called my wife to tell her that there had been an explosion or something and that we were leaving, and then hung up. David was back, so we swept the office and then went to the stairs and started down ourselves.
And for those that have tuned in late, again, what floor were you on and how many flights to get down?
78, so there were 77 floors to go of stairs to go down.
You know, they say, Michael, that things go in slow motion when there's stress. How long did it seem to take for you to get down? Did it seem...
Oh, it seemed as long as it took. It was an hour to get from the time the plane hit to the time that we got outside was an hour.
Once you get outside, obviously, you use the term pandemonium. There's a panic. I can think of several different ways to explain it. You were there. What was going through your mind?
We had no idea what was going on, but when we got outside, David said that he saw fire in Tower 2. We had no idea that anything had happened to Tower 2 because from our vantage point, going down the stairs in Tower 1, we didn't even feel the building or the ground shake when Tower 2 was hit. So we had no clue about that. So basically for us, what we did was just focused on getting away. David, once we got outside, did look and see fire in Tower 2. We ended up walking over to Broadway and then going north and actually stopped at a street that put us diagonally across from Tower 2. We stopped so I could try to call my wife, Karen. I called her when the plane first hit, and I told her that there had been an explosion or something and that we were leaving. And then I couldn't reach her in the stairwell, of course, because it's just this completely metal-lined cocoon. Yeah, it's just very, it's, of course, in the interior part of the building, there just wouldn't be cell service there anyway. And so when we got outside, we were walking and got to the street diagonally across from Tower 2. I tried to call her again and couldn't get through because the circuits were busy. I had just put my phone away, and David was putting his camera away when a police officer yelled, "Get out of here, it's coming down," and we heard the sounds of Tower 2 starting to collapse.
Yeah, describe that sound, if you could.
I can only describe it as kind of a combination of a freight train and a waterfall. I mean, you could hear the glass tinkling as things broke, and these loud cacophonies of sounds, and then it just became this deafening roar with the clickety-clack of the glass breaking and falling in the meanwhile. It was just all Tower 2 coming down. So I describe it as a freight train, combination freight train waterfall sound.
And what did you do?
I ran. Yeah. Everyone ran. I mean, there was nothing else to do unless you just wanted to stay there and wait for something to fall on top of you. Exactly. So everyone had turned and run. David was gone. It was just me and Roselle working together as a team. We turned and ran. We ran to the corner of Broadway and the next street now going south. Turned right, caught up to David. We continued to run, got engulfed in the dust cloud, all the dirt and debris that everybody has seen on television. And then our priority changed from running away from that tall building to getting out of this dust because the debris was so thick that I could feel more dirt, debris, and air going down my throat than I could, or dirt, debris, and dust going down my throat than I could feel air. So we were suffocating in it. David said it was so thick you couldn't see your hand 6 inches in front of your nose. So we had to get out of that horrible, wretched stuff. So I told Roselle to keep going and then turn right, and I kept using the command right, right, because I wanted her to turn into the building that we were running next to when she first saw an entrance. Well, I detected an entrance about the time and heard the entrance about the time she saw it. She turned right, took one step, and stopped dead. For me, that was a clue that she had stopped for some reason, and I reached out and discovered that we were at the top of a flight of stairs. Mm-hmm. So we went down the stairs into the entrance to the subway station at Fulton Street and Broadway, the Fulton Street station. Then a gentleman came up and introduced himself as Lou from the subway system, took us all down, there were a number of us there, to an employee locker room where there were water fountains and a fan and just benches to sit on to try to figure out and cope with what was going on, and we were there for about 10 minutes when a police officer came and said, "You need to leave now, the air's clear up above," and we went up above and back out the way we had come, and sure enough, the air was a little better than it had been, mm-hmm. and we just used that to walk further away from the subway station. And then we had gotten about 10 minutes or a quarter of a mile or so away when suddenly we heard that freight train waterfall sound again, and we knew it was our building coming down.
Jeez.
So we just ran to avoid a dust cloud and just waited until it all passed, and then looked around, and David said, "Mike, there's no World Trade Center anymore. It's just pillars of smoke and fingers of fire hundreds of feet high." I tried to call my wife again, and this time got through. She's the one that told us that two aircraft had deliberately been crashed into the two twin towers of the World Trade Center, one into the Pentagon, and a fourth was still missing over Pennsylvania at that time.
Michael Hankson's here. Check out his webpage. There's a clickable link in the show notes, and we're going to talk about his new book, Thunderdog, in just a minute. My question about 10 years, Mike, is 10 years. Does it seem like 10 years, or does it seem like 10 minutes since this happened?
You know, time has certainly flown by, but at the same time, thinking of all the things that have happened, yeah, it seems like 10 years. It just seems like it's hardly any time has gone by since 10 years, but at the same time, a lot of things have happened, and I know that a lot of things have happened. So it's just an incredible situation. I now own my own company. I travel the world speaking about teamwork and trust. Corporations hire me to come and do motivational speeches at meetings, inspirational speeches. Organizations ask me to come. We do our best to work with their budgets. But it is the way I earn my living. And we've actually now started, and we're just finishing up the incorporation of the Roselle's Dream Foundation, www.rosellesdream.org, R-O-S-E-L-L-E-S-Dream.org. And the purpose of the foundation will be to raise funds to educate people about blindness and and inclusion and so on, and to teach people about teamwork and trust. But it will also be to help people, starting in the U.S. at least, to be able to buy technology that would otherwise cost many thousands of dollars. We're not going to be able to pay all of the money, but we'll certainly provide scholarships to pay for portions once we are able to start raising money. So we are not taking applications for scholarships yet because we don't know how much we'll have to spend until we see how the giving goes. But the idea will be that we'll hopefully help people be able to subsidize some of the cost of their technology purchases.
We've talked about Roselle. Let's talk about Thunderdog. Tell the folks about it.
About
Thunderdog.
Thunderdog is not a 9/11 book. It is being published around 9/11. It was actually released last month, and it's been a New York Times bestseller ever since it came out. It's a little bit serendipitous and coincidental that it came out this year on 9/11. I've been working on writing it for a long time and not getting anywhere, and then last year we made a major breakthrough and also met a literary agent who helped us bring it about. I met my co-author, Susie Florey, who knew Chip McGregor, who's the agent that we use. He's the top literary agent in the United States. Chip entertained the proposal with a little skepticism at first, but then we gave him the book proposal and what it would be like. He shopped it around and found Thomas Nelson Publishers out of Nashville, Tennessee. They are the sixth largest publisher in the world and the largest publisher of inspiration and faith books. And of course, this is all of that. But they took it and helped us bring it about. And in actually very short order, it was published, and that turned out to be August 2nd of this year. It's, as I said, not a 9/11 book. It's a book about inspiration. It's a book about hope and about teamwork and telling people that even in the most adverse circumstances possible, there are ways to go forward and to deal with challenges that you have. So although a lot of people are focusing on it this particular week because of September 11th, it transcends that and goes well beyond it, because our story has sections dealing with what happened to me and a step-by-step process. Each chapter begins with a portion about 9/11, then it transitions to some other aspect in my life, and then we come back to 9/11 before we continue on. So everything gets tied as much as we can neatly at the end of each chapter, and then certainly by the end of the book, everything gets tied up in a very clean knot.
The website, michaelhinkson.com, there's a link in the show notes. The book is Thunderdog. Michael, always a pleasure. Let's not wait so long to talk again.
No, let's not. And what was the website with the show notes?
It's www.scaredmonkeys.com.
Scaredmonkeys.com, right.
Or scaredmonkeysradio.com. There'll be show notes and a clickable link to get to your webpage right there.
Cool. Well, we'd love to do it again and talk about some of the issues in more detail and all that. We expect Thunderdog to be around for a while, so we hope that people will buy it, read it, go to your local bookstore, or go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon or whatever. Or if you want, you can go to our website and buy it in either print or audio format. If you use audible.com, the download service, it's available there as well.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
That's Michael Hinkson. He was there. Blind. 78 floors. His guide dog, Roselle. I interviewed Michael many, many years ago, long before my Scared Monkeys days and my old talk show. And I thought, why not bring Mike back? Very interesting gentleman. I encourage you to go to his webpage. Pick up the book, Thunderdog. We all love animals here at Scared Monkeys. You can get a paw. What did he say? A pawgraph? Roselle's paw. Sadly, Roselle passed away. I know what that's like. I lost my dog, Brandy, a few years ago. 16 years having a dog. And when they pass, it's like losing a member of the family. I sat down with famed forensic pathologist Cyril Wecht and author Donna Kaufman to discuss their new book, Crime Scene to Courtroom, and some of the high-profile cases that are in the media today. Cyril Wecht is always an interesting interview, and here's what they had to say. Okay, welcome back. This is the Dana Pritzer Show. You'll know my next guest, author Donna Kaufman and famed forensic pathologist Cyril Wecht. Their most recent book, A Question of Murder, is on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, wherever you can find it, your local bookstore. And they have a new book coming out October 1st that I'm sure we'll talk about as the days and months go on, from crime scene to courtroom. Welcome, both of you. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting us.
Dr. Wecht, I know you're going to be doing some media on the feet, the tennis shoes that seem to be washing up on the shore of, in this case, most recently, British Columbia, not too far away from where I live. Let's talk about that a little bit. How strange is this to happen?
Well, I think the strange things about what's happening is, number one, this goes over a four-year period now, from August of 07 to the present time. Number two, I'm not sure if the number is 8 or 10 or 12. It depends on which report I read. Number three, all these feet are reportedly found within tennis shoes, shoes that athletic-type shoes, Nike, New Balance, whatever, and so on. No other parts of bodies, to my knowledge, have been reported, at least that I'm aware of, that have been matched to these feet. So the benign, simple approach, evidently, that has been adopted, as I understand it, by some of the law enforcement agencies, I don't know all, is that, well, because tennis shoes may be buoyant, that's why they keep these bones within the shoes from sinking. Well, that I don't know about the relative buoyancy factors of tennis shoes compared to other shoes, but a couple of observations. How come we're not getting this reported phenomenon in serial fashion from farther down in the California coast, over in the New York, New England coast, Florida coast, and elsewhere around the world? I'm not aware of it. Number two, how is it that no other parts of these bodies have been found? And number three, you can talk about buoyancy of the shoes, but if you're talking about skeletonized bones, they're not going to remain intact within the shoes. If there is no soft tissue holding them together, then they are just a bunch of loose bones.
Yeah.
And there's no way, you might have one or two wedged in, that's possible, but the feet aren't going to remain. And all up there in the Washington, British Columbia coast and so on, something doesn't make sense. I think that this really requires a further investigation.
Absolutely. It's a
And they can tell from if there's an ankle bone, whether it's from natural disarticulation or whether it's from a tool.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good point, Donna.
Yeah.
Right. And now they can make some determinations if they have some tissues to work with, male, female. Maybe if there's some soft tissue, they might be able to establish the race of the individual. And also then, within a range, the age of the individual, not like in fiction with precise calculation, but, you know, between the ages of 20 and 30, or a teenager or an adult or so on. And also, the structure of the bones sometimes can give you an idea of the occupant, of what that individual did. And then they have to take the DNA and look around the DNA databases available in British Columbia and Washington and see whether they match with anybody and find out who's been missing. Once they know that it's a Caucasian female between the ages of 20 and 35, then you send out the bulletins and see who's been missing around that area and within this time frame. So, you know, you have some parameters of a fairly limiting nature. I don't know. I don't want to be too critical because I'm not sure what's being done. But from what I have read, it just doesn't seem like any big, serious investigation has been undertaken.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. What we've seen so far is the report of the shoe, but after that, we don't hear anything more. Donna Kaufman and forensic pathologist Cyril Wecht here. Donna, let's talk just briefly about A Question of Murder. Those that missed our last interview, just give a quick synopsis of what the book's all about.
Well, Question of Murder is
is about five different cases, all of them Dr. Wecht worked on. He has performed 17,000 autopsies on his own and has consulted on another 37,000. And so he has a lot of cases to choose from. I have been an investigative reporter for many years, and so three of the cases I have worked on independently, or four actually, and one was new to me. But there, Anna Nicole and her son are both in the chapters, and we get more into who these people were in life as well as what made them die.
Right.
And the cases are all death investigations. There are two San Diego young girls who were killed in different ways and with horrible problems with the investigations on one of them, and Dr. Wecht solved that problem and saw that the right person got put in jail. And in one, I provided a clue that was helpful to authorities. And then the fifth chapter is one, if you have a relative or loved one in managed care in a hospital setting, this is really something you need to read.
Yep.
Dr. Wecht was nothing short of heroic in this, and it's a chilling case of what happened in New Orleans post-Katrina, when there was a doctor who went around to a number of patients, a couple dozen patients, as a matter of fact, and injected them to provide involuntary euthanasia, and admitted doing so, but conned the powers that be into not prosecuting her. And Dr. Wecht provided absolute evidence of the murders of these patients, and you know, unfortunately, he wasn't listened to. He put together a whole team of experts. They all agreed independently, and New Orleans just didn't want to hear about it.
Yeah.
Now, there's no statute of limitations on murder.
No.
And
no.
Hopefully that doctor and the people who gave her her marching orders will get some consequences at some point.
Absolutely.
It hasn't happened yet.
Dr. Wecht, we're seeing in the media quite a bit, and most recently with West Memphis. We can talk about JonBenet, if you like. Let's talk about the difference. And we all know Investigation 101, forensics, witnesses, eyewitness testimony, whatever. The police will take the case, put it together. We compare 1990s to 2011. We're seeing cases that are coming forward now saying what was done back then is wrong. Today we're seeing, again, West Memphis. Will we see something finally happen with a JonBenet because of the advancement in technology?
Well, there are two different kinds of investigative pursuits. With regard to eyewitnesses that you touched upon, we have programmed that here at our Institute of Forensic Science and Law at Duquesne University, and many other people have too. And this is not something new, but police and prosecutors have ignored this because it is something that they can control. They have been, in some instances, contrived in the most blatant fashion. It is known and has been known for a long time. It isn't as if you see that something new has been discovered. The report you're talking about is a wonderful report, and the people that put it together deserve credit. But and digging it out required some work and so on. But there is no new technique except that they have now come forward with specific recommendations as to how these should be conducted. So
you're talking about West Memphis.
Yeah, but I'm saying how they conduct the eyewitnesses, the eyewitness lineups, and so on. You know, we could talk for a couple hours on that.
Sure.
But basically, you have to do them in the most objective, detached fashion. Bring in people, officers, for example, who are not even involved in that investigation. Make sure that the people in the lineup look as closely and look as much like one to the other as possible. They all look like Donna. She's a suspect. They all look like me if I'm the suspect. You know, not people that look vastly different, and on and on and on. Now, JonBenet there are no eyewitnesses. And as far as your question, Dana, about technique and so on, we've got everything there. It isn't a matter, in the JonBenet Ramsey case, of the police having failed subsequently. There was a lot of negligence ab initio. I mean, failure to do the proper investigation, failure to find a body, my God, for 7 hours right. in the house where the child lay, and a lot of other things. But since then, in terms of the DNA and so on, and, you know, there has been a serious impasse, which is not a secret, except that the vast majority of people are unaware of it, between some of the police and the district attorney's office, the original DA, Alex Hunter, and subsequent DAs. And some of the police were reprimanded, and some of them were threatened, and I think one or two of them may even have been sued, and so on. They wanted to pursue that case. It was more the prosecutor, a real different kind of a twist, isn't it, from what we usually encounter. So I don't know. My answer is, and it pains me to say it, that nothing is ever going to happen with JonBenet. Patsy Ramsey is dead. That yeah. leaves John out there all by himself. And while, as Donna pointed out, talking about another matter, there's no statute of limitations on murder, still nobody is going to bring charges against John Ramsey. And as far as an outside intruder is concerned, one of my favorite lines is, and I think, I don't know, you know, Dana, that I don't have much hair. And I stand before an audience, and I'd love to say that when the next time you see me, I say to an audience, and I have a full head of luxuriant hair, 3 inches long, and it's all mine, that's when the intruder in the JonBenet Ramsey case will be uncovered.
Donna Coffin and Cyril Wechter here. Donna, put your investigative reporter hat on. We're seeing a lot of the cold cases reenacted, I guess, for lack of a better term, different mystery television shows, crime shows. We talk about them on this show, and it's good. There are teams of cold case investigators that are out there. But when you look at that, you look at the cold cases from the 90s, the JonBenets, you know, West Memphis, and then you parallel them to the Casey Anthonys. And here's a case where there was an acquittal. Media coverage like you'd never believe. In fact, the Anthonys are going on Dr. Phil or something, whatever. How important is it to get the coverage like we see today as far as concluding the case? Or were cameras in the courtroom a big problem with the Anthony and case? And is that one of the reasons why she was acquitted?
I don't think so. I think cameras in the courtroom should be mandatory in every murder trial, and as far as cameras, period, I think the Supreme Court of the United States should have cameras, too. So that's never a problem. More openness is never a problem. I have covered JonBenet since the day after her body was found, and I have covered the Casey Anthony from the beginning as well. And our current book, From Crime Scene to Courtroom, is about the Casey Anthony case in part, as well as Drew Peterson and Michael Jackson and some other cases. So we reveal a lot of what the jury was never informed about, which had a lot to do with why they didn't convict her. It feels very much like the prosecution was very arrogant and pretty much gave up halfway through. And now the prosecutor is writing a book.
Yeah,
how did
that.
He find time to do that? Maybe he should have been paying attention to his case while it was being tried. I don't know how he could have, within minutes of finishing that case, be pitching a book that's already written 256 pages. That just blows my mind.
Yeah.
You know, what was his main threat? And this was the case that he retired on? I just am shocked about that. Anyway, but there were a lot of mistakes made there by the prosecution, and we go into all of these elements in our book. But, you know, it is also the jury system, and we have to like it. You know, like it when it happens the way we want it to go down, and also when it doesn't. That's just how our system works.
Cyril, when you obviously you've testified in court dozens and dozens of times, but is it fair to expect 12 people on a jury to understand laypersons, to be able to come in a week, in a month, whatever, to be able to understand the forensics, to understand the importance of the evidence, whether you're there for the defense, whether you're there for the prosecution? Is that something wrong with the jury system that needs to be changed?
Damon, it is not only unfair, or it is absurd. You have a case in which let's take Casey Anthony, forensic pathologist, anthropologist, entomologist, death experts, etc., and so on, or a malpractice case. I've been involved in cases with 8, 10, 12 experts on each side. Let's say a brain-damaged baby. I won't enumerate them, but take my word, 10 to 12 experts on each side on a brain-damaged baby case, which can result in a verdict of $5, $10, $15, $20 million. And so, you know, there's no expense spared. The idea that a jury, I don't give a damn who they are, that they are going to absorb, comprehend, analyze, digest, and intellectually and objectively review what has been presented to them when all of those experts spent 10, 12, 20 years going to school, learning their trade. Think about it. What is more ridiculous in the world? You know, to summarize, we could talk about this for an hour. With regard to juries, I've testified hundreds of times, Dana. I plagiarize Winston Churchill's remark: "Democracy is a terrible form of government. There's just nothing that is acceptable as an alternative." My words, but that's what he said. And the jury, a jury system is ridiculous. Yeah. It is a terrible way of dispensing justice. But in our country, and I'm saying our country, not necessarily Canada or any of the countries in the world, but in the United States of America, there is regrettably nothing that is alternatively acceptable. Why? Because if you have one judge, you see, one judge. He's an ultra-conservative Republican. She's an ultra-liberal Democrat. You know what I mean? You come in, you're doomed. You're doomed. And so that's the only argument that has validity for the retention of the jury system. That jury in the case in the Casey Anthony case, I've said, was a jury from a distant planet. Not that I disagree with Donna, yeah, but I don't agree that the totality of the absurd jury verdict in that case can be laid at the doorstep of the prosecution. This
well,
is
that's
a jury.
Absolutely,
I mean,
right.
These you happen. You get these
notes.
Aberrations. You get juries. That's why I say I would never. I have been in cases. I mean, privately, I said to myself, "There's no way," or "This is a sure pop," or so on. And to my absolute amazement. So, you know, to read a jury is impossible. And while some great trial attorneys have had much success, believe me, it's a crapshoot.
Absolutely. Donna, I'll give you the last word.
They did not take notes, and they did not ask for any readbacks. They did not ask for any exhibits to be shown to them in the jury room. They used a few hours to filter down six weeks of testimony, and you know, so
there you are.
They really did not do their due diligence as jurors.
Absolutely. Well said, as always. Don't forget, come October 1st, Donna and Dr. Weck's new book, From Crime Scene to Courtroom, will be available. Thank you, folks. I always appreciate it.
Thank you, Dana.
Thank you
for having us.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All
Thank
the best.
Thank you so much. Good night.
That's famed pathologist Cyril Wecht and author Donna Kaufman. Their current book, A Question of Murder, can be found at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all those places, your local bookstore. And don't forget their new book, From Crime Scene to Courtroom, coming October 1st. This is the Dana Prentzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
And we are right back. I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Cyril Wecht said it best, the Anthony jury is from another planet. Check out www.scaredmonkeysradio.com for podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries. You can listen to the show live. You can leave comments. You can do almost anything there. We'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Prentzer Show.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.